Bill's election, a testament to how much he had come to love and respect him. By Labor Day, Bill's campaign was picking up momentum, and the Republicans began a barrage of personal attacks and dirty tricks. When President Nixon was in Fayetteville for the 1969 Texas versus Arkansas football game, a young man climbed into a tree to protest the Vietnam War and Nixon's presence on campus. 5 years later, Bill's political opponents claimed that Bill was the guy in the tree. It didn't matter that Bill was studying in Oxford, England at the time, 4,000 miles away. For years after, I ran into people who believed the charge. One of Bill's mailings to voters was not delivered, and the bales of postcards were later found stashed behind a post office. Other incidents of sabotage were reported, but no foul play could be proved. When election night came that November, Bill lost by 6,000 votes, 52% to 48%. At the end of the school year, I decided to take a long trip back to Chicago and the East Coast to visit friends and people who had offered me jobs. I still wasn't sure what to do with my life. On the way to the airport, Bill and I passed a red brick house near the university with a for sale sign out front. I casually mentioned that it was a sweet-looking little house and never gave it a second thought. After a few weeks of traveling and thinking, I decided I wanted to return to my life in Arkansas and to Bill. When Bill picked me up, he asked, "Do you remember that house you liked? Well, I bought it. So now you'd better marry me because I can't live in it by myself." Bill proudly drove up the driveway and ushered me inside. The house had a screened-in porch, a living room with a beamed cathedral ceiling, a fireplace, a big bay window, a good-sized bedroom and bathroom, and a kitchen that needed a lot of work. Bill had already bought an old wrought iron bed at a local antique store and had been to Walmart for sheets and towels. This time, I said yes. We were married in the living room on October 11, 1975, by the Reverend Vic Nixon, a local Methodist minister. I walked into the room on my father's arm, and the minister said, "Who will give away this woman?" We all looked at my father expectantly, but he didn't let go. Finally, Reverend Nixon said, "You can step back now, Mr. Rodham." After all that has happened, I'm often asked why Bill and I have stayed together. It's not a question I welcome, but given the public nature of our lives, it's one I know will be asked over and over again. What can I say to explain a love that's persisted for decades and has grown through our shared experience of parenting a daughter, burying our parents, and tending our extended families? A lifetime's worth of friends, a common faith, and an abiding commitment to our country. All I know is that no one understands me better, and no one can make me laugh the way Bill does. Even after all these years, he is still the most interesting, energizing, and fully alive person I have ever met. Bill Clinton and I started a conversation in the spring of 1971, and more than 30 years later, we're still talking. Bill Clinton's first election victory as Attorney General of Arkansas in 1976 was anticlimactic. He had won the primary in May and had no Republican opponent. The big show that year was the presidential contest between Jimmy Carter and Gerald Ford. I was thrilled that Carter won the national election. Bill and I had to move to Little Rock, which meant leaving the house we had been married in. I had to decide what to do next, and I began to seriously consider joining a private firm. The Rose Law Firm was reputed to be the oldest firm west of the Mississippi. I had gotten to know one of the partners, Vince Foster, while I was running a legal aid clinic at the law school. After 1976, Vince and another Rose Firm partner came to see me with a job offer. I joined the litigation section, and the two lawyers with whom I worked most were Vince and Webster Hubbell. Vince was one of the best lawyers I've ever known and one of the best friends I've ever had. If you remember Gregory Peck's performance as Atticus Finch in To Kill a Mockingbird, you can picture Vince, steady, courtly, sharp but understated, the sort of person you would want around in times of trouble. Vince was born and raised in Hope, Arkansas. The backyard of his boyhood home bordered the backyard of Bill's grandparents, with whom Bill lived until he was 4. Webb Hubble was a big, burly, likable man, a former University of Arkansas football star and an avid golfer, which endeared him to Bill from the outset. He was great fun to work with and a loyal, supportive friend. In the first jury trial I handled on my own, I defended a canning company against a plaintiff who found the rear end of a rat in the can of pork and beans he opened for dinner one night. He didn't actually eat it, but claimed that the mere sight was so disgusting that he couldn't stop spitting, which in turn interfered with his ability to kiss his fiancée. He sat through the trial spitting into a handkerchief and looking miserable. There was no doubt that something had gone wrong in the processing plant. But the company refused to pay the plaintiff since it argued that he hadn't really been damaged. And besides, the rodent parts, which had been sterilized, might be considered edible in some places in the world. Although I was nervous in front of the jury, I warmed to the task of convincing them that my client was in the right, and was relieved when they awarded the plaintiff only nominal damages. For years after, Bill used to kid me about the rat's ass case and mimic the plaintiff's claim he could no longer kiss his fiancée because he was so busy spitting. Well, being a politician's wife, as well as a trial lawyer, occasionally got people talking when I stepped out in public. I was not usually recognized. Once, another attorney and I chartered a small plane to fly to Harrison, Arkansas for a court appearance, only to land at the airstrip and find there were no taxis. I walked over to a group of men standing around the hangar. "Is anybody driving into Harrison?" I asked. "We need to go to the courthouse." Without turning around, one man offered, "I am. I'll take you." The man drove an old junker stuffed with tools, so we all crammed into the front seat and headed for Harrison. We barreled along with the radio blaring until the news came on and the announcer said, "Today, Attorney General Bill Clinton said that he would be investigating Judge so-and-so for misbehavior on the bench." All of a sudden, our driver shouted, "Bill Clinton! You know that son of a bitch, Bill Clinton?" I braced myself and said, "Yeah, I do know him. In fact, I'm married to him." That got the man's attention, and he turned to look at me for the first time. "You're married to Bill Clinton? Well, he's my favorite son of a bitch, and I'm his pilot." This was when I noticed that our Samaritan had a black disc over one eye. He was called One-Eyed Jay, and sure enough, had been flying Bill in little airplanes all over. Now I just hoped old One-Eyed Jay's driving was as good as his flying, and I was grateful when he delivered us to the courthouse safe and sound, if a bit rumpled. The years 1978 through 1980 were among the most difficult, exhilarating, glorious, and heartbreaking in my life. After so many years of talking about the ways Bill could improve conditions in Arkansas, he finally had a chance to act when he was elected governor in 1978. In 1979, I was made a partner at the Rose Law Firm, and I devoted as much energy as possible to my job. Often I hosted social events at the governor's mansion or presided over meetings of the Rural Health Advisory Committee, which Bill had asked me to chair as part of his effort to improve access to quality health care in rural Arkansas. As if that weren't enough, Bill and I were also trying to have a baby. We weren't having any luck until we decided to take a vacation in Bermuda, proving once again the importance of regular time off. I persuaded Bill to attend Lamaze classes with me, a new enough phenomenon that it prompted many people to wonder why their governor was planning to deliver our baby. As my March due date drew near, my doctor said I couldn't travel, which meant that I missed the annual White House dinner for governors. Bill got back to Little Rock on Wednesday, February 27th, in time for my water to break. That threw him and the state troopers into a panic. Bill ran around with the Lamaze list of what to take to the hospital. It recommended bringing a small plastic bag that could be filled with ice to suck on during labor. As I hobbled to the car, I saw a state trooper loading into the trunk a 39-gallon black garbage bag filled with ice. Our daughter's birth was the most miraculous and awe-inspiring event in my life. Chelsea Victoria Clinton arrived 3 weeks early on February 27, 1980, at 11:24 p.m., to the great joy of Bill and our families. While I was recovering, Bill took Chelsea in his arms for father-daughter bonding laps around the hospital. He would sing to her, rock her, show her off, and generally suggest that he had invented fatherhood. Chelsea has heard us tell stories about her childhood many times. She knows she was named after Judy Collins' version of Joni Mitchell's song, Chelsea Morning, which her father and I heard as we strolled around the Chelsea district of London during the wonderful vacation we took over Christmas of 1978. Bill said, if we ever have a daughter, we should name her Chelsea, and he started singing along. I was able to take 4 months off from full-time work to stay home with our new daughter, though with less income. Bill and I both recognized the need for parental leave, preferably paid. That's why I was so thrilled when the first bill he signed as president was the Family and Medical Leave Act. As soon as Bill and I decided to start a family, I had begun to plan for a more stable financial future. Money means almost nothing to Bill Clinton. He's not opposed to making money or owning property. It simply has never been a priority. I started looking for opportunities I could afford, and my friend Jim Blair was someone who knew the intricacies of the commodities market, and he was willing to share his experience with me and my friend and later his wife, Diane Blair. I was willing to risk $1,000 and let Jim guide my trades. The commodities market has more in common with Las Vegas than Wall Street. What investors buy and sell are promises, known as futures, to purchase or sell certain goods, wheat, coffee, cattle, at a fixed price. If the price is higher when those commodities are brought to market, the investor makes money. On the other hand, if the market in hog bellies or corn is glutted, then the price drops and the investor loses big. Soon after I got pregnant with Chelsea in 1979, I lost my nerve for gambling. The gains I had made suddenly seemed like real money we could use for our child's higher education. I walked away from the table $100,000 ahead. Jim Blair and his compatriots stayed in the market longer and lost a good deal of the money they had made. The large return on my investment was examined ad infinitum after Bill became president, although it never became the focus of a serious investigation. The conclusion was that, like many investors at the time, I'd been fortunate. Bill and I weren't so lucky with another investment we made during the same period. Not only did we lose money on a piece of property called Whitewater Estates, the investment would spawn an investigation 15 years later that endured throughout Bill's presidency. It all started one day in the spring of 1978, when a businessman and longtime politico named Jim McDougal approached us with a sure thing deal. Bill and I had entered a partnership with Jim and his young wife Susan to buy 230 undeveloped acres on the south bank of the White River in North Arkansas. The plan was to subdivide the site for vacation homes, then sell the lots at a profit. The price was $202,611.20. Jim McDougal was a character, charming, witty, and eccentric as the day is long. With his white suits and baby blue Bentley, McDougal looked as if he'd just stepped out of a Tennessee Williams play. Despite his colorful habits, he had a solid reputation. He seemed to do business with everybody in the state, including the impeccable Senator J. William Fulbright, for whom he helped make a fortune in real estate. His credentials were reassuring to both of us. If all had gone according to plan, we would have turned over the investment after a few years, and that would have been the end of it. But by the time the development was surveyed and the lots were ready for sale, interest rates had gone through the roof. Rather than take a huge loss, we held on to Whitewater, making some improvements and building a model home while hoping for an economic turnaround. From time to time over the next several years, Jim asked us to write checks to help make interest payments or other contributions, and we never questioned his judgment. We didn't realize that he was becoming involved in a raft of dubious business schemes. 1980 was a big year for us. We were new parents, and Bill was running for re-election. Bill's Republican opponent, Frank White, began running negative ads. Though exit polls showed Bill winning by a wide margin, he lost 52% to 48%. He was devastated. Bill had now lost two elections, one for Congress, one as an incumbent governor, and many wondered whether this defeat would break him. Before the week was out, we found an old home to buy in the Hillcrest section of Little Rock, near where we had lived before. On two lots, it had a converted attic that we used for Chelsea's nursery. Chelsea was the only bright spot in the painful months following the election. It was in our new house that Chelsea celebrated her first birthday, learned to walk and talk, and taught her father a lesson in the perils of multitasking. One day, Bill was holding her while watching a basketball game on television, talking on the phone, and doing a crossword puzzle. When she couldn't get his attention, she bit him on the nose. Bill took a job at Wright, Lindsay & Jennings, a Little Rock law firm. He was soon unofficially campaigning to get back his job as governor. The pressures on me to conform had increased dramatically when Bill was elected governor in 1978. Because I knew I had my own professional interests and did not want to create any confusion or conflict of interest with my husband's public career, it made perfect sense to me to continue using my own name. Bill didn't mind, but our mothers did. Virginia cried when Bill told her, and my mother addressed her letters to Mr. and Mrs. Bill Clinton. Brides who kept their maiden names were becoming more common in some places in the mid-1970s, but they were still rare in most of the country, and that included Arkansas. The winter after Bill's defeat, a few of our friends and supporters came to talk to me about using Clinton as my last name. Chelsea's birth announcement featuring our two names apparently had been a hot subject of conversation around the state. Jim Blair joked about staging an elaborate scenario on the steps of the Capitol. Bill would put his foot on my throat, yank me by my hair, and say something like, "Woman, you're going to take my last name, and that's that." Flags would wave, hymns would be sung, and the name would change. The only person who didn't ask me or even talk to me about my name was my husband. He said my name was my business. I decided it was more important for Bill to be governor again than for me to keep my maiden name. So when Bill announced his run for another term on Chelsea's second birthday, I began calling myself Hillary Rodham Clinton. After Bill's election in 1982, a humbler, more seasoned governor returned to the statehouse, though no less determined to get as much done as possible in 2 years. Bill announced that he was forming an education standards committee to recommend sweeping educational reforms, and he wanted me to be its chair. By the end of Bill's term in office, Arkansas had a plan in place to raise school standards. Starting in 1987, more than a few Democratic Party leaders were urging Bill to consider a run for the presidency in 1988. Much has been written about the reasons for his decision not to run, but it finally came down to one word: Chelsea. Carl Wagner, a longtime Democratic activist and father of an only daughter, told Bill he would, in effect, be turning his daughter into an orphan. Mickey Cantor delivered the same message while he and Bill sat on the back porch of the governor's mansion. Chelsea came out and asked Bill about our upcoming vacation plans. When Bill said he might not have one if he ran for president, Chelsea looked at him and said, "Then Mom and I will go without you." That sealed the decision for Bill. Chelsea was beginning to understand what it meant to have a father in the public eye. The 1986 governor's campaign was the first one she had been old enough to follow. Bill and I tried to prepare Chelsea for what she might hear about her father, or for that matter, about her mother. We sat around our dinner table in the governor's mansion role-playing with her, pretending we were in debates where one of us acted like a political opponent who criticized Bill for not being a good governor. Chelsea's eyes grew big at the idea that anyone would say such bad things about her daddy. I loved Chelsea's growing assertiveness, though it wasn't always convenient. Around Christmas 1988, I went duck hunting with Dr. Frank Campuris, a distinguished surgeon and a good friend of mine, who invited me to join him, his two doctor sons, Drew and Dean, and a few other buddies at their hunting cabin. I hadn't shot much since my days at Lake Winola with my dad, but I thought it would be fun. That's how I found myself standing hip-deep in freezing water, waiting for dawn in eastern Arkansas. When the sun rose, the ducks flew overhead, and I made a lucky shot, hitting a banded duck. When I got home, Chelsea was waiting for me, outraged to wake up and learn that I had left home before dawn to go kill some poor little duck's mommy or daddy. My efforts at explaining were futile. She didn't speak to me for a whole day. After Bill was reelected governor in 1990, Democrats across the country approached him once again about running for president. That encouragement reflected the assessment that George H.W. Bush was out of touch with most Americans. Although Bush's popularity remained astronomical in the aftermath of the Gulf War, I thought his performance on domestic issues, particularly the economy, made him vulnerable. In June of 1991, Bill attended the annual Bilderberg Conference in Europe, which brought together leaders from all over the world. After listening to Bush administration officials defend their policies, he called me to tell me how frustrated he was. "This is crazy," he said. "We're not doing anything to get the country ready for the future." I could tell that he was seriously thinking through the arguments he would make if he decided to run. When we attended the annual Governor's Conference in Seattle in August, I was not surprised that a number of his Democratic colleagues told him they would support him if he was serious about running. After the conference, Bill, Chelsea, and I took a short vacation to Victoria and Vancouver, Canada, to talk over what he should do. Chelsea, now 11, was ready to offer her opinions. She and I agreed. Bill could be a good president. As Bill discussed the pros and cons, he assured Chelsea that his schedule would include all her important dates, like the annual Arkansas Ballet performance of the Nutcracker. Even if Bill's run failed, he would have the satisfaction of knowing he had tried, not just to win, but to make a difference for America. That seemed to be a risk worth taking. If the first 44 years of my life were an education, the 13-month presidential campaign was a revelation. Despite all the good advice we'd received and all the time Bill and I had spent in the political arena, we were unprepared for the hardball politics and relentless scrutiny that comes with a run for the presidency. I relied on my friends and staff to help us through the rough patches. Bill put together a terrific team. I had begun to assemble my own staff as soon as Bill announced his candidacy. This was a departure from protocol in which the candidate's staff controls his wife's schedule and message. I was different, something that would become increasingly apparent in the months ahead. The first person I called for help was Maggie Williams, then in a PhD program at the University of Pennsylvania. Maggie and I had worked together at the Children's Defense Fund during the 1980s. Although she couldn't come on full-time until late 1992, she offered advice and support throughout the campaign. Three young women who started working for me in the campaign became invaluable and stayed with me through the 8 White House years. Patty Solis, a politically active daughter of Mexican immigrants, had grown up in Chicago. As my scheduler, she ran my life hour by hour for 9 years. Capricia Penevic Marshall, a dynamic young lawyer from Cleveland, was also the daughter of immigrants, a Mexican mother and a Croatian father. She was hired to do advance work. Her good-humored grace under pressure served her and me well when later she became the White House social secretary. Kelly Craighead from California was already an experienced events planner when she started doing advance work for me. Her slogan, "Fail to plan, plan to fail," became one of our campaign mantras. Knowing that she was looking out for me gave me comfort and confidence on even the hardest days throughout the White House years. I learned quickly that in a race for the presidency, nothing is off limits. I was in Atlanta campaigning on January 23rd when Bill called to warn me about an upcoming tabloid story in which a woman named Jennifer Flowers claimed she'd had a 12-year affair with him. He told me it wasn't true. The campaign staff went into a tailspin over the story, and I knew that some of them thought the race was over. Like a rampant virus, the Flowers story hopped between species of media, from The Star, a supermarket tabloid, to Nightline, a respected network news show. Something had to be done. Bill's team recommended that we appear on the Sunday night television show 60 Minutes right after the Super Bowl. Although the interview lasted 56 minutes, CBS broadcast about 10 minutes. Apparently, most Americans agreed with our basic point, that the election was about them, not our marriage. 23 days later, Bill became known as the Comeback Kid for his strong second-place finish in the New Hampshire primary. In early March, with the Democratic primary season in high gear, former California governor and Democratic presidential candidate Jerry Brown went on the offensive against Bill, focusing on my law practice and on the Rose Law Firm. Brown accused Bill of steering state business to the Rose Firm to increase my income. It was a spurious and opportunistic charge that had no basis in fact, and it's what led to the infamous Cookies and Tea incident. Bill and I were at the Busy Bee Coffee Shop in Chicago, trailed by a gaggle of cameras and microphones. A reporter asked me about whether I could have avoided an appearance of conflict of interest when my husband was governor. My answer was long and rambling. I made an awkward attempt to explain my situation and to suggest that many women who juggle careers and lives are penalized for the choices they make. It turned into a story about my alleged callousness towards stay-at-home mothers because of an answer I gave to a follow-up question about whether I could have avoided an appearance of conflict of interest when my husband was governor. I replied, "You know, I suppose I could have stayed home and baked cookies and had teas, but what I decided to do was fulfill my profession, which I entered before my husband was in public life, and I've worked very, very hard to be as careful as possible, and that's all I can tell you." Some of the attacks, whether demonizing me as a woman, mother, and wife, or distorting my words and positions on issues, were politically motivated and designed to rein me in. Others may have reflected the extent to which our society was still adjusting to the changing roles of women. After Bill won the California, Ohio, and New Jersey primaries on June 2nd, his nomination was assured, but his election was not. After all the negative publicity in the campaign, he was running third in the polls behind Ross Perot and President Bush. In July 1992, the Democratic Party held its convention in New York City to formally nominate Bill and his running mate, Al Gore. On the final night of the convention, we were giddy and elated as we all hugged and danced on the stage. The next morning, July 17th, we started on our magical bus tours, or as I called them, Bill, Al, Hillary, and Tipper's excellent adventures. Traveling on the buses gave us all a chance to get to know one another better. Bill, Al, Tipper, and I spent hours talking, eating, waving out the window, and stopping the bus convoy to conduct impromptu rallies. One evening in the rural Ohio River Valley, we stopped at the farm of Gene Brandstuhl for a barbecue and a meeting with local farmers. As we were getting ready to leave, Brandstuhl said some folks had gathered at a crossroads a few miles away, and we should stop. It was a lovely summer night, and people were sitting on their tractors waving flags while children stood at the edge of fields holding signs and welcoming us. My favorite said, "Give us 8 minutes, and we'll give you 8 years." In the waning light, we were astonished to see thousands of people filling the large field. Back in Little Rock, the vast third floor of the old Arkansas Gazette building served as Clinton campaign headquarters. One night, Patty Solis's phone rang in the back of the headquarters in Little Rock. Another campaign aide rushed to pick up the receiver and for no particular reason blurted out, "Hillary Land." The name stuck. Over time, my confidence that Bill would win the election grew. Americans wanted new leadership. To Bill and me, no issue was more distressing than the health care crisis in America. Everywhere we went, we heard story after story about the inequities of the health care system. In New Hampshire, Bill and I met Ronnie and Rhonda Makos, whose son, Ronnie Jr., had been born with a serious heart condition. When Ronnie lost his job and his health insurance, he faced crushing medical bills to provide the care his son needed. I don't think Bill expected that health care reform would become a cornerstone of his campaign. After all, James Carville's famous war room slogan was, It's the economy, stupid. But the more Bill studied the problem, the clearer it became that reforming health care insurance and reining in skyrocketing costs were integral to fixing the economy as well as taking care of people's urgent medical needs. Bill and I spent election day at the governor's mansion with family and friends making calls to supporters around the country. At 10:47 p.m., the television networks declared that Bill had won. Within hours, the kitchen table in the governor's mansion became the nerve center of the Clinton transition. In the next few weeks, potential cabinet nominees came in and out. Phones rang around the clock. Piles of food were consumed. We were also facing the more mundane challenges of any family changing jobs and residences. In the midst of forming a new administration, we had to pack up the governor's mansion, the only home Chelsea remembered. And since we didn't own a house of our own, everything would come with us to the White House. Friends pitched in to organize and sort, piling boxes in every room. Loretta Avant, a friend from Arizona, took charge of the thousands of gifts that arrived from all over the world, filling a huge section of the large basement. Periodically, Loretta would shriek up the stairs, "Wait till you see what just came!" And I'd go down to find her clutching a portrait of Bill made out of seashells and mounted on a red velvet background, or a collection of stuffed dogs dressed in baby clothes sent to our now famous black and white cat, Sox. We had to find a new school in Washington for Chelsea, who was almost a teenager and not happy with the prospect of dismantling her life. I had taken a leave of absence to campaign, but now I resigned my law practice and started putting together a staff for the office of First Lady, while helping Bill in any way I could. We were both grappling with what my role should be. There is no training manual for first ladies. You get the job because the man you married becomes president. Like all first ladies before me, I had to decide what I wanted to do with the opportunities and responsibilities I had inherited. As I studied the marriages of previous presidents, I recognized that Bill and I were not the first couple who relied on each other as partners in life and politics. We now know about the political advice Abigail Adams provided her husband, which earned her the derogatory nickname Mrs. President. The unofficial presidency run by Edith Wilson after her husband's stroke, and the political firestorms ignited by Eleanor Roosevelt. Like those of many previous White House inhabitants, the relationship that Bill Clinton and I had built was rooted in love and respect, shared aspirations and accomplishments, victories and defeats. That wasn't about to change with an election. After 17 years of marriage, we were each other's biggest cheerleaders, toughest critics, and best friends. Yet it wasn't clear to either of us how this partnership would fit into the new Clinton administration. We didn't know precisely what my role would be until late in the transition, when Bill asked me to oversee his health care initiative. During inaugural week, our families and personal staff stayed with us in Blair House, the traditional guest residence for visiting heads of state and presidents-elect. Blair House is famous for being able to accommodate any special need. Our crew was tame compared to certain visiting heads of state who demanded that their guards be nude to ensure they carried no weapons or imported their own cooks to prepare everything from goat to snake. Bill gave a lot of speeches that week, but he still hadn't finished writing the biggest one of his life, the inaugural address. He finally finished writing and rehearsing the big speech an hour or two before dawn on the morning of his inauguration. We slept very briefly and then started our extraordinary day with an emotional interfaith service at the Metropolitan AME Church. Then we went to the White House, where the Bushes greeted us at the North Portico with their spaniels, Millie and Ranger, darting around their legs. They were very welcoming and put us at ease. Although the campaign had been bruising for both our families, Barbara Bush had been gracious to me when we had met in the past and had given me a walking tour of the family quarters of the White House after the election. The Gores and others joined us at the White House, and President and Mrs. Bush guided our party to the Blue Room, where we had coffee and made small talk for 20 minutes or so, until it was time to leave for the Capitol. Bill rode in the presidential limousine with George Bush, while Barbara Bush and I followed in another car. The crowds lining Pennsylvania Avenue cheered and waved as we passed. I admired Mrs. Bush's elan as we prepared to watch one president, her husband, make way for another. At the Capitol, we stood on the West Front with its breathtaking view down the mall to the Washington Monument and the Lincoln Memorial. The huge crowd spilled out beyond the monument. Following custom, the United States Marine Band struck up Hail to the Chief one final time for George Bush just before noon, and again to the new president a few minutes later. Chelsea and I reverently held the Bible as Bill took the oath of office. Then he gathered Chelsea and me in his arms, and kissing each of us, whispered, "I love you both so much." Bill's speech stressed the themes of sacrifice and service for America, and called for the changes he had featured in his campaign. "There is nothing wrong with America that cannot be cured by what is right with America," he said, calling Americans to a season of service on behalf of those in need at home and those around the world with whom we must help to build democracy and freedom. After the swearing-in ceremony, while some of our new staffers hurried to the White House to start unpacking and organizing our things, Bill and I lunched in the Capitol with members of Congress. After lunch, Bill, Chelsea, and I drove from the Capitol down the parade route to the Treasury building. There, with the Secret Service's reluctant blessing, we got out and walked along Pennsylvania Avenue to the reviewing stand in front of the White House, where I sat down in front of a space heater to watch the parade. Because Democrats hadn't had a winner in 16 years, everyone wanted to participate. We couldn't say no and didn't want to. There were 6 marching bands from Arkansas alone in a parade that lasted 3 hours. We first walked into the White House as its new residence in the early evening after the last float passed by. It was during my walk up the path toward the White House and up the stairs of the North Portico and into the grand foyer that the reality hit me. I was actually the First Lady, married to the President of the United States. That night, after the inaugural balls, we headed back to the White House well after 2 a.m. When we stepped out of the elevator into the second floor residence, we looked at each other in disbelief. This was now our home. Too tired to explore these grand new surroundings, we crashed into bed. We had been asleep for only a few hours when we heard a brisk knock on the bedroom door. Bill bolted up in bed and I groped for my glasses in the dark, thinking there must be some sort of emergency on our very first morning. Suddenly the door swung open and a man in a tuxedo stepped into the bedroom carrying a silver breakfast tray. This is how the Bushes began their day, with a bedroom breakfast at 5:30 a.m., and it's what the butlers were accustomed to. But the first words this poor man heard from the 42nd President of the United States were, "Hey, what are you doing here?" You never saw anyone back out of a room so quickly. Bill and I just laughed and settled back under the covers to try to steal another hour of sleep. It struck me that both the White House and we, its new occupants, were in for some major adjustments, publicly and privately. I suspected that our family's casual lifestyle and round-the-clock work habits were bound to be as unfamiliar to the staff as the formality of the White House was to us. While Bill and I had nothing but respect and admiration for the Secret Service, I knew I would never get used to the Secret Service agent posted outside our bedroom door. This was standard operating procedure for past presidents, and the Secret Service was adamant at first about keeping it that way. "What if the president has a heart attack in the middle of the night?" one agent asked me when I suggested that he station himself downstairs instead of with us on the second floor. "He's 46 years old and in great health," I said. "He's not going to have a heart attack." The Secret Service adapted to our needs, and we to theirs. That day, after our open house at the White House and other obligations ended, Bill and I were finally free to change into casual clothes and have a look around our new home. After a whirlwind week of inaugural festivities, it felt good to relax with our family and closest friends, people we had known for years and trusted completely. At the end of the evening, we decided to raid the small family kitchen off the West Sitting Hall. Our friend Harry Thomason and Bill checked the cabinets while Linda Thomason and I opened the refrigerator. It was empty, except for one item, a half-full bottle of vodka. We used the contents to toast the new president, the country, and our future. Maggie Williams had agreed to help me at the end of the 1992 presidential campaign. but only if I understood that she would return to Philadelphia after the election to finish her PhD at Penn. With the election over, I realized I needed her more than ever. I begged, pleaded, implored, and hounded her to stay on through the transition, then to join the administration as my chief of staff. Our first job was to recruit other staffers, pick office space, and learn the intricacies of the traditional First Lady duties. No First Lady or her staff had ever had offices in the West Wing or the old Executive Office Building. Although the Visitor's Office, Personal Correspondence, and Social Secretary would remain headquartered in the East Wing, some of my staff would be part of the West Wing team, so I thought they should be integrated physically as well. Maggie made her case to Bill's transition staff and secured an office for me on the second floor of the West Wing, just down the hall from the domestic policy staff. As part of my staff of 20, I had a domestic policy staffer assigned to my office full-time, as well as a presidential speechwriter designated to work on my speeches, especially those relating to health care reform. These changes were important if I was going to be involved in working on Bill's agenda, particularly as it related to issues affecting women, children, and families. Soon my staff became known around the White House as Hillary Land. We were fully immersed in the daily operations of the West Wing. My top staff had titles on par with the president's top staff and attended senior staff meetings. But we were also our own little subculture within the White House. We had toys and crayons for children in our main conference room, and every child who visited knew exactly where we stashed the cookies. One Christmas, Milan Verveer, my deputy chief of staff, ordered lapel buttons that read in very small letters, Hillary Land. And she and I began handing out honorary memberships, usually to long-suffering spouses and children of my overworked staffers. Membership entitled them to visit anytime and to come to all of our parties. On January 26, a bitterly cold morning, just a few days after the inauguration, I flew to New York City. Officially, I was going to New York to receive the Lewis Hine Award for my work on children's issues and to visit PS 115, a local public school, to promote voluntary tutoring. But I was also making a private stop to have lunch with Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis at her beautiful apartment on Fifth Avenue. I had met Jackie a few times before and had visited her once during the 1992 campaign. She had been an early supporter of Bill's, contributing financially and attending the convention. The Secret Service dropped me off at her apartment shortly before noon, and Jackie greeted me at the elevator door on the 15th floor. She was impeccably dressed, wearing silk pants in one of her signature colors, a combination of beige and gray, and a matching blouse with subtle peach stripes. At 63, she remained as beautiful and dignified as she was when she first entered the national consciousness as the glamorous 31-year-old wife of the second youngest president in American history. The first thing I noticed about her apartment was that it was overflowing with books. They were stacked everywhere, on and under tables, beside couches and chairs. Books were piled so high in her study that she could rest her plate on them if she was eating at her desk. She is the only person I've met who literally decorated her apartment with books and pulled it off. We sat at a table in the corner of her living room overlooking Central Park and the Metropolitan Museum of Art and continued the conversation we had begun at our lunch the summer before. Jackie gave me invaluable advice about how to deal with my loss of privacy, and she told me what she had done to protect her children, Caroline and John. Providing Chelsea with a normal life would be one of the biggest challenges Bill and I faced, she told me. You've got to protect Chelsea at all costs, Jackie said. Surround her with family and friends, but don't spoil her. Don't let her think she's someone special or entitled. Keep the press away from her if you can, and don't let anyone use her. Already, Bill and I had taken a measure of the public's interest in Chelsea and the national fascination with a child growing up in the White House. Our decision about where to send Chelsea to school had inspired passionate debate inside and outside the Beltway, largely because of its symbolic significance. I understood the disappointment felt by advocates of public education when we chose Sidwell Friends, a private Quaker school. But the decision for Bill and me rested on one fact. Private schools were private property. hence off-limits to the news media. So far, our instincts and Jackie's prescriptions had served Chelsea well. She was adjusting to her new school as comfortably as could be expected, although she missed her friends from Arkansas. She was settling into her two rooms on the second floor. They had been Caroline's and John's, and then Linda and Lucy Johnson's, so Jackie knew exactly where they were. One was now Chelsea's bedroom with twin beds so she could have sleepovers, and the other was a den where she could do homework, watch television, listen to music, and entertain friends. I told Jackie how grateful I was that she had created a dining room upstairs and that we were converting the butler's pantry into a small kitchen where we could eat our family meals in a more relaxed and informal atmosphere. Jackie and I also discussed the Secret Service and the unusual security challenges that the children of presidents presented. She confirmed my instincts that even though security was necessary, it was important to stress to Chelsea, as she had to her own children, that Chelsea owed respect to the agents sworn to protect her. I had seen children of governors boss around and even defy the middle-aged state troopers assigned to guard them. Jackie told me about the time an older kid had taken John's bicycle, and he'd asked his security detail to get it back for him. When Jackie found out, she told John he would have to stand up for himself. The Secret Service uses code names for its protectees, and each member of a family has a name beginning with the same letter. Bill became Eagle, I was Evergreen, and Chelsea, appropriately, was called Energy. The code names sound whimsical, but they mask a harsh reality. Ongoing threats require the vigilance and intrusiveness of protective security. Jackie spoke frankly about the peculiar and dangerous attractions evoked by charismatic politicians. She cautioned me that Bill, like President Kennedy, had a personal magnetism that inspired strong feelings in people. She never came out and said it, but she meant that he might also be a target. He has to be very careful, she told me, very careful. Not all our conversation was so serious. When I asked her if I should just turn myself over to a team of famous fashion consultants, as some in the media had recommended, she looked horrified. "You have to be you," she said. "You'll end up wearing someone else's idea of who you are and how you should look. Concentrate instead on what's important to you." Her words were a relief. After lingering for 2 hours, it was finally time for me to leave. Jackie urged me to call or be in touch if I ever had questions or needed to chat. Until her untimely death from cancer 16 months later, she remained a source of inspiration and advice for me. I was reassured after my visit with Jackie, but the respite didn't last long. Bill and I had worried about the problems we would face when we moved into the White House, but I never expected that the way I defined my role as First Lady would generate so much controversy and confusion. We were living in an era in which some people still felt deep ambivalence about women in positions of public leadership and power. In this era of changing gender roles, I was America's Exhibit A. The scrutiny was overwhelming. Occasionally, I snuck out of the White House wearing sweats, sunglasses, and a baseball cap. I loved walking through the mall, looking at the monuments, or riding my bike along the C&O Canal in Georgetown. I bargained the Secret Service down to only one agent, dressed in casual clothes, walking or biking behind me. These moments of quiet anonymity were fleeting. On January 25th, Bill invited me and two guests to lunch in the president's small study near the Oval Office. Carol Rasco, the newly named White House domestic policy advisor who had served in Bill's administration in Arkansas, and our old friend Ira Magaziner, a successful business consultant who had produced a groundbreaking study on healthcare costs. In a few hours, Bill planned to unveil a healthcare task force and announced that it would produce reform legislation during his first 100 days in office. Few on the White House staff knew that Bill had asked me to chair the task force or that Ira would manage the day-to-day operations as a senior advisor to the president for policy and planning. After the Navy stewards brought us our food from the White House mess, Ira delivered troubling news. Some Capitol Hill veterans were warning him that our timetable for delivering a health care reform bill in 100 days was unrealistic. We had been encouraged by the electoral success of Harris Wofford, the new Democratic senator from Pennsylvania, who had campaigned on a healthcare platform and often told crowds, "If criminals have the right to a lawyer, working Americans have the right to a doctor." But Ira was getting a different message. "They think we're going to get killed," said Ira, who hadn't touched his sandwich. "We'll need at least 4 to 5 years to put together a package that will pass Congress." On this day, it was Bill's boundless optimism and his determination that kept me in my chair. "I'm hearing the same thing," Bill said. "But we have to try. We just have to make it work." There were compelling reasons to push ahead. By the time Bill became president, nearly 37 million Americans, most of them working people and their children, were uninsured. The terrible cycle of escalating costs and declining coverage was largely the result of a growing number of uninsured Americans. Patients without insurance seldom could afford to pay for their medical expenses out of pocket, so their costs were absorbed by the doctors and hospitals that treated them. Insurers, confronted with having to cover higher doctor and hospital rates, began trimming coverage and raising the price of premiums. As the price of premiums went up, fewer employers were willing or able to provide coverage for their workers, so more people lost their insurance, and the vicious cycle continued. Reform was not only good public policy that would help millions of Americans, it also was inextricably tied to reducing the deficit. Bill, Ira, Carol, and I walked out of the Oval Office, past the bust of Abraham Lincoln, and across the narrow hall to the Roosevelt Room, where a crowd of cabinet secretaries, senior White House staff, and journalists was waiting for what the official schedule listed as a task force meeting. Bill declared that his administration would present a health care reform plan to Congress within 100 days, a plan that would take strong action to control health care costs in America and to begin to provide for the health care needs of all Americans. Then he announced that I would chair a newly formed President's Task Force on National Health Care Reform. He said, "I am grateful that Hillary has agreed to chair this task force, and not only because it means she'll be sharing some of the heat I expect to generate." Some of our friends gave us lighthearted warnings about what lay ahead. "What did you do to make your husband so mad at you?" Mario Cuomo, then governor of New York, asked me during a White House visit. "What do you mean?" "Well," Mario replied, "he'd have to be awfully upset about something to put you in charge of such a thankless task." I heard the warnings, but I didn't fully realize the magnitude of what we were undertaking. My work in Arkansas running the Rural Health Care Task Force and the Arkansas Education Standards Committee didn't rival the scale of health care reform. Democrats in Congress were urging us to move quickly. A few days after Bill's announcement, House Majority Leader Dick Gephardt asked to meet with us. One of Congressman Gephardt's chief worries was that we would be unable to unify Democrats, who were seldom united under the best of circumstances. Health care reform widened existing divisions. Democratic members had already begun to outline their own models for reform in order to influence the president's plans. Bill and other Democrats rejected the single-payer and Medicare models, preferring a quasi-private system called managed competition that relied on private market forces to drive down costs through competition. The government would have a smaller role, including setting standards for benefit packages and helping to organize purchasing cooperatives. The best model was the Federal Employees Health Benefit Plan, which covered 9 million federal employees and offered an array of insurance options to its members. Prices and quality were monitored by the plan's administrators. Under managed competition, hospitals and doctors would no longer bear the expense of treating patients who weren't covered, because everyone would be insured through Medicare, Medicaid, the veterans and military health care plans, or one of the purchasing groups. Perhaps most important, the system would allow patients to choose their own doctors, a non-negotiable item in Bill's view. Gephardt was sure that Republicans in the Senate would filibuster any health care package we put forward. Ira and I trooped up to Capitol Hill the following day to meet with Majority Leader George Mitchell and left his office with a clearer sense of what needed to be done. Slowly I was learning what a steep mountain we were climbing, and on February 24th, we were dealt a blow that none of us anticipated. Three groups affiliated with the healthcare industry sued the task force over its composition claiming that because I was not technically a government employee, since first ladies derive no salary, I was not legally allowed to chair or even attend closed task force meetings. There was certainly nothing secret about hundreds of people participating in this process, but the press, which was not invited to meetings, jumped on the issue. It was a deft political move, designed to disrupt our work on health care and to foster an impression with the public and the news media that we were conducting secret meetings. We were trying to move too quickly on a bill that would fundamentally alter American social and economic policy for years to come, and we were already losing the race. In this climate, and with Bill weathering controversies over gays in the military and his nominations for attorney general, we savored any successes that came our way. In the middle of March, the House passed Bill's economic stimulus package, and my staff and I decided to have our own small celebration. On March 19th, about 20 of us gathered for lunch in the White House mess. The room, with its oak-paneled walls, navy memorabilia, and leather-cushioned chairs, was a perfect setting for private conversation and as much laughter as we could muster. The gathering offered me a rare opportunity to let my hair down with trusted aides and to speak my mind about whatever topic was under discussion. From the moment I set foot in the room, I could feel my mood lighten and my mind relax for the first time in days. Lunch arrived, and we began sharing stories of our first few weeks in the White House. Then I saw Carolyn Huber enter the room, one of my longtime assistants from Arkansas, who had come with us to Washington. Carolyn walked over to my chair and bent down to whisper in my ear, "Your father has had a stroke," she said. "He's in the hospital." Within hours, Chelsea, my brother Tony, and I were on a plane to Arkansas for a long, sad trip home. I can't remember landing in Little Rock that night or driving to the hospital. My mother met me outside the intensive care unit, looking drawn and worried, but thankful to see us. Dr. Kampouras explained to us that my dad had slipped into a deep, irreversible coma. We could visit him, but it was doubtful he would know we were there. At first, I was concerned about taking Chelsea to see her grandfather, but she insisted, and I relented, because I knew how close she felt to him. Chelsea and I held his hands. I smoothed his hair and spoke to him, still clinging to a small hope that he might open his eyes again or squeeze my hand. Chelsea sat by his side and talked to him for hours. My brother Hugh arrived later that night from Miami and joined us in Dad's room. Hugh started telling family stories and singing songs, especially the ones that used to get such a rise out of my father. One of his frequent tirades concerned my brother's taste, or lack thereof, in television shows. He particularly despised the theme song to The Flintstones. So Hugh and Tony stood on either side of his bed and sang that inane song, hoping to provoke some sort of reaction. "Shut that noise up!" as it had when we were kids. If he heard us that night, he never showed it, but I want to believe that somehow he knew we were there for him, just as he had been for us when we were kids. Mostly we took turns sitting next to Dad's bed, watching the mysterious green blips on the monitors rise and fall, succumbing to the hypnotic whir and click of the respirator. The center of my turbulent universe of obligations and meetings contracted to that small hospital room in Little Rock, until it became a world unto itself, removed from all concerns except the things that matter most. Bill arrived Sunday, March 21st. I was so happy to see him and could feel myself relax for the first time in 2 days as he took charge of talking to the doctors, helping me think about the decisions we would soon have to make about my father's medical options. Our good friend Harry Thomason flew in from the West Coast. He had made travel arrangements for Virginia and her husband Dick Kelly, who had been out of town and who arrived at the hospital Sunday night. Bill and I thought they had been in Las Vegas, their favorite destination, but Harry pulled Bill and me aside to deliver more tragic news. He told us, as gently as he could, that Virginia and Dick had not been in Nevada for a vacation. They had been in Denver, where Virginia was exploring experimental treatments for the cancer that had returned and spread after her mastectomy 2 years before. She did not want us to know how sick she was. We decided to respect Virginia's wishes for now, It was best to deal with one family crisis at a time. The day after Bill arrived, he had to fly back to Washington. Luckily, Chelsea didn't have to miss school because it was spring break. She stayed with me in Little Rock, and I was